Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest is Michael of Benicia. Michael, welcome to the program.
Hey, Vinnie. Great to be here.
Could you elucidate as to what exactly Benicia means? Is it anything like Elysium?
Nothing at all, in fact. It is the name of what is currently known as Northumberland, or Northumbria, in northeastern Britain.
Oh, right.
And it used to stretch all the way up to about where Edinburgh is now in Scotland, all the way down to around about where York is now.
Oh.
So that's the name I take.
Okie dokie. Well, without further ado, let's get you to explain a little bit about who you are and what it is you do.
Okay. Well, I suppose the best place to start is 2008. In 2008, I got to the point where I could no longer continue to acquiesce to any part of what I saw as a tyrannical state. So in September 2008, after doing an awful lot of legal research, I ended up serving a notice of understanding and intent and claim of right upon the woman acting as the Queen of England, revoking my consent to be governed and letting her know how I was going to conduct myself from there on in. Around about 6 months later, I amended that document and it became a sovereign declaration in which I proclaimed that it was my sole mission upon this planet to found a community in which we would lay down the foundations of a society where our children would find it easier to self-realize, and we'd find it easier to self-realize ourselves. And it was called the Universal Community of Self-Realization, the nation that I founded not long after that. I declared that in March 2009, that was my intention. I received absolutely no objection from any government department or from the Queen. I also received no acknowledgement. And so I proceeded as I'd given her notice and declared that I would. And others came forward who took the same position as I, and we joined forces. And basically what we created was a community of sovereign nations, which is known as Universal Community Trust. And this community of sovereign nations has established by memorandum of understanding following six months after we had entered into a treaty, which is called the Treaty of Universal Community Trust. And we served that treaty upon the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. and we awaited their response. We received no response, and 6 months after that, we served a memorandum of understanding upon Elizabeth and the Foreign Office, in which we stated the terms of the mutual understanding that had arisen. And that basically comprises of Her Majesty's government not raising any legal objection to 12 aims and objectives that we laid down in the treaty. And I could go on and perhaps on and on, letting you know.
Actually, I'd invite you to, because I would like to hear more.
Okay, so basically these 12 aims and objectives, they set forth everything that Universal Community Trust and everyone who stands under Universal Community Trust, it sets forth everything that we are aiming to bring about. And I think probably the best way to continue is for me to actually read them to you. It won't take long if you want to go through them.
Oh, she's right. Go for your life.
The first one is an end to all crimes against mankind and the earth that are currently being perpetrated by governments, whether elected or not, corporations, organizations, individuals, and legal entities of all natures and descriptions. Two, the dismantling of all industries which, by developing, manufacturing, and exploiting for profit any substance, product, or byproduct, cause actual damage, harm, injury, or loss to mankind and or damage to the earth. Three, the deconstruction of unsustainable fiscal systems that would facilitate one man to have and one man to have not, including, without limitation, the abolition of usury in all of its forms and the demonopolization of land rights, international borders, mediums of exchange, trading platforms, and the means of communicating, publishing, and distributing information. Four, the nullifying settlement and or discharge of all outstanding or allegedly owed debts, obligations and liabilities with a view to replacing unaccountable, unsustainable and inequitable usury-based financial systems with localized and autonomous permanent credit facilities or depositories in every community that stands under the jurisdiction of Universal Community Trust. Five, the eradication of all forms of artificial scarcity and its effects, including homelessness, famine and disease, by and through the facilitation of a naturally abundant, peaceful, free, and harmonious environment for mankind to dwell, and the distribution of organic materials, agricultural produce, seeds, and proven natural health remedies. Six, the dissolution of mankind's dependence upon fossil fuel industries for the production of energy, including, without limitation, coal seam gas mining, coal-fired power stations, and oil drilling, as well as the cessation of all toxic pollution of the biosphere of the earth in any detrimental form whatsoever, whether it be gaseous, liquid, solid, or radioactive, and the closure and cleanup of all unsafe nuclear power facilities. Seven, the rapid development, manufacture, distribution, and implementation of new and existing free and clean energy technologies in every community upon the earth under Universal Community Trust. Eight, a ceasefire in all wars, the repatriation of all armed services personnel following the repudiation of all unlawful allegiances and the setting aside of all oaths made in the service of private interests to the detriment of mankind, and the unequivocal commitment of the parties to this treaty to recall and withdraw any and all beneficiaries of Universal Community Trust from every armed conflict at the earliest opportunity. Nine, the establishment of cooperative trade networks in and between all communities with a view to promoting the localization of trade, self-sufficiency, mutual cooperation, and the eventual replacement of money with unconditional pledges of sweat equity, which shall form the basis for the permanent credit of every beneficiary of Universal Community Trust. 10. An agreement that privately issued promissory notes made payable to bearer on demand by any grantor, trustee, or beneficiary of Universal Community Trust may be used for the purposes of settling any valid financial obligations or to create credits in their account held at the community's depository, the balance of which will be transferable to any account in another jurisdiction, provided those credits are not used for any purpose that is detrimental to mankind and or the earth. 11. The nullifying of any and all judicial proceedings and convictions for victimless crimes, as well as the positive law which legalized such unlawful proceedings, and the prohibition and prevention of any man being charged with future crimes. 12. The facilitation of the re-emergence of the universal bond of common unity between the free indigenous peoples of the earth in order to achieve these aims and objectives in the most peaceful, amicable, and equitable manners.
It sounds very similar to a piece of legislation I myself have concocted called the Suppression of Scumbaggery Act.
Yes, yes, I believe that could be a very good subtitle for it.
Yeah. And I think that what you've got here is basically like, it's about making all of the lies of our society true again, okay? Because, you know, we've got governments to allegedly protect us, but they don't. So that lie needs to be made true so that they actually do protect us and do their job. Politicians, they promise things and they tax you for it and it's just a big lie. And I've concluded that the only thing that actually needs to make society work again is all of these systems that are big lies, just turn them into truth, and I think it'll actually work quite well.
Me too. And there's a lot of other people that think exactly the same. And a way to express it, another way to express it, is we have to reverse all the ill effects of globalization and monopolization. And without expressing what it is that's actually wrong, no one can understand what the solutions actually are. But to express it as you have so eloquently, we're basically putting the truth back into communities. We're putting the truth back into our own existence, but we're also holding the truth up for all of the programmed masses to see, because we can only do this together. We can't. There's no way that one tiny community can live like this, like we've proposed, in the world the way it is now.
Mm.
There's no way it would be possible.
Yeah, because there's two types of people in the world. Those that want to be left alone and those who won't leave you alone.
That's right. And even though the ones that won't leave us alone are a tiny minority, the vast majority of the people on the planet are still brainwashed into thinking that there is something called authority which will come down on them like a ton of bricks if they don't obey every single diktat of a tyrant.
And in most cases, they'd actually be correct, wouldn't they?
Yes, in most cases, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, I think it's that's how you know that you're really not free, that you're actually a slave. I mean, you're free to watch X Factor, Big Brother, and Coronation Street, but you're not free to protest fracking.
That's right. That's right. They are attempting to, within the European Union, such as it is, to make pretty much anything that we'd want to do that would subvert the authoritarian line illegal. Now, I have to also say that while what you said before is completely true, that most of the time when you stand up to the state, you have a major problem to deal with. And sometimes they won't back down. And good, decent, honest people are being thrown out their homes by pirates and mercenaries every single day for alleged debts to banks, which any researcher who's taken more than 2 hours to look on the internet can determine for themselves that the banks do not lend any money, and they haven't for a very long time. They create credits and then charge compound interest on this electronic money that they create.
Kind of like Star Trek. And here's another point that I think actually really bears looking upon as well. If you have a look, and we're talking about a system here, okay, and everybody talks about the system, and I wanted to understand from your perspective, what is the system? Could you define it?
Yes, but the system is not the same as it was prior to 1815. So I can describe it as it has become since 1815. In the most simplistic terms, it is a globalized system of corporatist policy being imposed upon all the indigenous peoples of the planet in order to convince them that they have absolutely no choice but to live a certain way and be dependent upon the state for certain things and to rely on the state for as many things as possible in order that they become so compliant with the system because it provides them with everything that they think they need that the very thought of giving up what the benefits and privileges of the system, it brings them out in hives. You know, they wake up in a cold sweat at the thought of not paying tax, of saying to the tax man, Well, I'm sorry, can you provide me proof that I have to pay you a penny from my income? And this is another topic that you may want to discuss, because I actually managed to establish with HM Revenue and Customs that I am not a taxpayer and cannot be considered a taxpayer, and I haven't received an income tax return or a demand or a letter from Her Majesty's Revenue Collectors since they accepted that they could not prove that I was any form of taxpayer. However, when I haven't paid tax in a number of years, that I don't return the tax returns, that I don't comply with any orders of the system, that I don't feel morally obliged to comply with, they laugh at me usually, and they, or they get very nervous because they think, they imagine what it would be like if they did that. And the system has created almost an automatic default setting of fear and anxiety when questioning any aspect of the system. And this has been done covertly. And according to my research, and I'm not the only one who's saying it, but there aren't that many of us who's saying it, this has all been done covertly by the House of Rothschild, who took control of world trade. And they already had a good hold on international finance, which they pretty much created. But they've controlled all trade since the Battle of Waterloo. Hmm. Since Nathaniel Rothschild, famously, he created a panic on the stock exchange by making everyone believe that he tipped his hat, and he sold everything he had to create the panic, and then he bought it back at a rock bottom price. And by doing so, he not only took control of the East India Company, he took control of the crown, because the crown were, for all intents and purposes, the East India Company and the Virginia Company and the East Africa Company, etc., etc.
Well, the crown realized that when you come in with a crest and a literally, I'm a king, I'm a queen, I'm a crown, or whatever. People don't like that because they assume that you're dominating them, that you're some kind of hereditary dictator. You know, I wonder why people would think that. And so they figured out, you know what? Actually, people like corporations because they think that there's nobody behind them. They think that it's just a normal, loving, caring entity that's just there to do business and what have you. And eventually it just kills and enslaves you because you don't realize that they're there to kill and enslave you.
Yes. Yes, very much. And at the same time, let's look at it this way. Let's look at it this way. Since 1815, every single purported political revolution that's been written about in the history books, every single one of those revolutions was fomented by the money power of the Rothschilds and the agents of the Rothschilds. And this is provable that there's so much evidence out there, but I have documented an awful lot of it on my website, which is selfrealization.com, for all those who don't know. Now, sorry, were you going to say something?
I was going to say, I watched a television show, I think it might have been mid last year, called The Aristocrats. Have you heard of this television show?
It goes
into the personal lives of the wealthy, rich, and powerful, and what have you. And the only reason why I watched this television show this one time is because I was flipping through the channels, and they said, "And this week we're going to be looking at the Rothschilds." And I was like, "Whoa, I'm going to watch this." You know what they did? They said, "Oh, the poor Rothschilds. They're Jewish. They're outsiders. You know, really pity. We always are afraid of getting discriminated against by people." As he sets up this like multi-million-dollar think tank facility and pays artists $1,000 per brush stroke in order to do giant murals across the freaking walls. It's like, did the Rothschilds pay these producers to make a puff piece so that people wouldn't see them for the tyrannical scum that they are? I don't give a frack that they're Jewish. I do care that they're scumbags.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, it's so easily demonstrated that they've controlled virtually all the mainstream media since the 80s. And they had most of it before that. But it was consolidated very much in the 80s. And then if you look at every single genocidal plan that has been implemented over the past 150 years, you will, if you follow the money, if you look for who is financing it, you will see that at the end of the line is a Rothschild or a Rothschild agent.
Mm. And Rockefellers are Rothschild agents as well, aren't they?
Either Rothschild agents or illegitimate Rothschilds.
Ah, and also this brings us into, you mentioned the word illegitimate. I interviewed Alan Watt about the elite breeding programs, and it turns out that there's this really, really incestuous relationship among the elite of the world, in some cases, quite literally.
That's right.
And I see a parallel here between the elite of the worlds being related to the New Zealand justice system. I think we've got like 160, 180 High Court justices, give or take, and I think like about 120 of them are first cousins.
Right.
So whenever you want an investigation into a corrupt judgment, the likelihood is you're probably going to get their cousin doing
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Well, one of the other things that I've been heavily involved with for the past 4 or 5 years is the fight for justice over mortgages on these shores.
Mm.
And if you just consider that, by our reckoning, and there are a lot of people who have taken on the banksters on these shores now, where when we first started, there were two or three of us who were going into the courts, including the High Court, and making the claims that could be easily proven, not just by using their statutes, citing numerous judicial authorities in support of the arguments that we were making. And we could only draw one conclusion at the end of it all, when judge after judge after judge after judge threw out what we were saying as totally without merit in English law. And bear in mind, Vinny, we are citing the English law. We are citing the judgments of English judges at the minute. No. It doesn't count in this case. It may count in other cases, but you've completely misconstrued it.
You know. Really, I've misconstrued the law that's supposed to protect my rights, that's actually there to just make me believe that I've got them so that you can take them away without me knowing about it. Is that what your job is, Mr. Judge? Are you a Freemason by chance? Oh, of course you are.
and if he's not a Freemason, if he's not a member of another secret society or club, if they haven't got something on him that they can bend his arm with at any juncture over any decision that he has to make, then you can bet your ass that he will have worked in the legal professions and he will have been conveying illegal mortgages.
Mm.
And therefore, if a judge who was actually part of the conveyancing industry and took part in what we can demonstrate was knowing all-out fraud by the banks over mortgages, if such a judge would give a decision to a mortgagor who was claiming that fraud had taken place over this mortgage and that the lawyers were involved and they were the ones who advised the mortgagor to sign on the dotted line before they even owned the property that they wanted to acquire, before they had the money to acquire it, they were told by their legal representatives that they had to sign on the dotted line, that the mortgage was to remain undated. They never went over all of the terms and conditions. Therefore, if a former conveyancing solicitor is sitting and they're hearing these kind of arguments from someone like me, and there are many, many more besides, it's not just myself and a couple of other people who've taken this on. There are now hundreds, if not thousands, of people flooding the courts with these issues, and every single judge, every single one of them, has thrown the case out and dismissed it as totally without merit, because if they admitted that we were right, they would be implicating themselves in the crimes of the banks.
Hmm. Okay. What's the definition of the word mortgage?
Well, it's
from the original Latin, I think it was.
Or is it Latin, isn't it? Yes, the original. Is it death pledge?
It's death grip, I think.
Death grip.
Yeah. Like you have depth gauges, and what they do is they grip and they measure the things. I think that's the origin of the word. And it seems actually quite apt, don't you think? you know, like a smartphone.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, and I think I was interviewing Lindsay Williams this one time, and he talked about how the Fed was buying $40 billion per month of mortgage-backed securities. And I was like, I remember, what was it? Was it Jefferson that said, those who give up their liberty for security receive and deserve neither, kind of thing? And so I defined a mortgage-backed security as a death grip backed by tyranny.
That's right.
You know, and that's basically what everything breaks down to. It's and they use this language deliberately, I believe.
They do. But if you imagine that the only recourse that the judges, and these are high court judges and court of appeal judges that we're talking about here, it's not just county court judges, it's them as well. But we're talking a lot of Queen's Counsel have taken part in this. They're all closing ranks. And the only way they can stop us making these arguments in the courts is by issuing what is known as civil restraint orders against us. And they've done this against every single one who has stood up against the banks in the courts. Every single one. But none of us are willing to shut up. Because the banks cannot prove that they lent any money. And they're kicking people, as I say, innocent, good, honest, decent people out of their homes every single day. And they did it to one of my very good friends and his mother this morning. And it was violent. It was tyrannous. And it was done almost on an industrial scale. They shut a street down with riot police at 5:30 in the morning in a quiet Midlands town on this island. They shut it down, and then they set to... They had all of the equipment necessary to cut through metal, to take off the bars and the protections that they put up to keep the bailiffs out. And then they violently tore my friend and his mother from their home, and thankfully they got it all on film. It was all captured on film. And they're going to go after the bastards who've done it. And they're not the only ones, Vinny. This is going on every single day here.
Oh, it's going on globally.
Yes, it's going on globally. I also have a friend who was evicted from a charitable housing project. She was evicted over an illegal tenancy agreement by a housing association. And she's a woman who was on her own in her early 60s, and she was evicted at gunpoint. Gunpoint. The police turned up in riot gear with guns. This has never happened on these shores before the last few years.
Mm.
It has. It's been ratcheted up a lot over the past 6 months to a year.
Well, one would say, oh, that's a bit over the top. If you were a tyrannical scumbag, on the other hand, and you wanted to set an example to the other slaves of the plantation, it makes perfect sense.
Yes, exactly. And this is it. If it weren't for the cognitive dissonance of the masses, not wanting to believe that their government, such as it is, that every single one of those governments is a puppet government run by some agent of the House of Rothschild internationally. But nevertheless, if they would only not believe that their government would never set about putting into action a plan to wipe out the vast majority of the population on this planet, just the damage that Wi-Fi is doing, that enough on its own.
Hmm.
That's enough to kill fertility.
Yep. And add on to that smart meters, smartphones, everything. And then add on to that the fluoride, and then add on to that the chemical weapons and the water supply and so on and so forth. Mate, it's like, I remember a video that I made when I was a lot younger. I said, we're living in a time now where we're living in a prison cell. And every single bar within that prison cell is a separate agenda designed to screw you over. So you're completely exactly surrounded at all times with many, many, many different types of things that are just fracking up your life, everybody's life, and could quite conceivably destroy the human race in perpetuity. People don't see it, not because it's invisible, but because they can't see it, right? It's like, do you remember that old story about how Columbus was coming towards what's now the United States, he came across, I think it was some Caribbean tribes or what have you on his way there, and these tribes people couldn't see his ships. It was just not in their minds. They'd never heard or thought about such a vessel, and as a result, they physically couldn't even see them coming into shore. And indeed, it was Sharman who had to enlighten their tribe's people so that they could actually open their eyes and be able to see the ships. Now, this is an old story, but I think it actually applies today. The Rothschild banking cartel, the New World Order, those are Columbus's ships, and people like yourself and myself are the Sharman trying to teach everybody to see them.
I think that's a very good analogy. And I also, well, it's more than a very good analogy, Vinny, because I've got those shivers. I've got, you know, my spine and the hairs on my arms are standing on end. And that's not because it's freezing in the Northeast, but it is, just to let you know. Nevertheless, I think that it's gotten to the point now where I think so many people have realized, right across the planet, but I can speak more clearly from my own experiences on this island. Everywhere you go, you go out your front door, you walk down the street. If you live in a city, you see pissed off, miserable people everywhere you go. You know, and I'm sure it's like that where you live as well.
Mm.
You know, so few people are happy doing what they're doing. They're constantly distracting themselves with technology and all the rubbish that they pump out on the mainstream media. It's all distraction. None of it is good for them. How often do you see three or four people walking down the street and they're texting on their phone, and they've got no idea that they're walking past somebody else who's texting on their phone, and they're walking past each other. You know, they could be perfect for each other, and their eyes never meet because they're texting on their phone, or they're looking at their phone, reading a text. It's like, what's going on here? Is anybody actually living in the present moment anymore?
People have turned into ships passing each other in the night.
In the day.
It's terrible. It's like almost like we've become dehuman, subhuman, right? Like gradually over time, we've been genetically modified and influenced and technologically transmogrified and so on and so forth to be less than human.
Yes, there's no doubt about that. That the connection between people, when I was growing up in the Northeast here. In the 70s, the connection between people was much greater than it is now. But you put it this way, my grandparents did not start locking their doors until the 1980s. Mm. They didn't. People just used to walk in and out of their house. They lived in a pit village. They had done their whole lives. It's where they were born. It's where they died. You know, I remember as a child asking them, why do you never lock the door? Well, then, if we locked the door, no one would be able to come in.
Oh my god. Well, I suppose now it's a good idea to lock your doors anyway, because otherwise police might come in.
Yes, exactly.
And evict you from your rightfully paid home.
Well, this is it.
Yeah.
This is it.
Yeah. Alright, well, we're going to take a break, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back. Michael of Benicia is my guest.
It's yours or if it's mine. What's the difference if it's yours or if it's mine?
And we're back. Michael Albanese is my guest. Do you have a website there?
Selfrealization.com.
Self-realization. Is it self-realization.com or just
yes,
one word?
Yes, thank you for correcting me. It's self-realization.com and realization with an S.
Ah, okay. And how long has that website been running, roughly?
Oh, it was launched in August.
Oh, okay. So relatively new there.
Yes, it is relatively new, but an awful lot of the material has been taken from my former website, freetheplanet.net, which some people might have known.
And how long had that been going for? Because I want to kind of, you know, when you want to understand, when you want to write a mystery novel, what you do is you start from the end and you work your way backwards. So can we start from today and work our way backwards to how this actually, this kind of, I would say, campaign or crusade of yours, where did it begin?
I wouldn't call it a crusade or a campaign, but I understand why you did, because you're right, you don't have the other pieces of the jigsaw. Well, I declared my own sovereignty. And I said I would live according to my own conscience, and that I would have no master. I would obey nobody. I would obey no diktat, no order, no directive, nothing. I would only agree to do something in advance of doing it. And it was difficult. It was difficult. But where this started, Vinny, and I wasn't sure if I was going to talk about this, but I think I should, because I feel like it's the right time. But in 3 days after 9/11, I met a Bilderberg insider online who was looking for a writer. And I was working in the film industry at the time. And I was writing screenplays. And she found me completely by chance. And we were both looking for someone to have a proper conversation about 9/11, about how bad it all looked, how obvious it was that something was amiss. And she confided to me that not only did she know that it was going to happen, she knew who did it, who arranged the finance, who organized the people involved, and she had known about it, along with a lot of other people she knew, since around about 98. So the 3 years preceding 9/11. She said it was a talking point in the private clubs, at the places such as on the East Coast of the US, where wives of millionaires and billionaires used to go for lunch. It was a talking point that there was going to be a staged event in New York, probably, although they didn't say it was definite, but probably in New York, that would bring about great change for the greater good. And when she confronted one of the women that she was having lunch with about this and said, "I haven't heard that. Where are you getting that from?" And she says, "Oh, pretty soon you'll hear about it." And she pressed her on it and she said, "Look, what are you talking about? Staged event. There's going to be something happening probably in New York, and a lot of people are going to die, but it will be for the greater good in the long run. The world will become a better place because of it." And she immediately thought about what Henry Kissinger had said about needing to get rid of the useless eaters by one way or another. And her husband, at that time, as well as being a senior politician in the US, he was also an international ambassador, and she described him as Henry Kissinger's right-hand man. Now, you can imagine, I've just met this woman online. I've got no idea whether she's telling me the truth, but I know that something in my heart is telling me that I've got to follow this up. So I start asking questions, and we have numerous conversations, and we started communicating two or three times a week over a period of months, where she confessed to me that she went to her husband knowing that he was very senior in the political and diplomatic realm, and knowing that if it was going to happen, then Kissinger would know about it, and Kissinger would have told him. So she confronted her husband and said, "Have you heard about this?" And she knew from the look on his face that he had, but he didn't say anything. And she basically said, "Look, I'm horrified by this. I think someone should alert the media. If you are saying this is actually happening, or this is going to happen, then someone needs to warn the people of New York." And at that moment, she told me that she knew her marriage was over, because the look on his face, it was a look she'd never seen before. And he said, "Whatever you do, don't do that." And their marriage hit the skids, as you can imagine. They had children, and he desperately tried to patch it up with her, and she wasn't sure whether to trust him. So she gave him a chance and agreed to go on a make-or-break holiday in Africa. And they went to Kenya. And his attitude changed completely towards her. And she was even starting to wonder if she could trust him again. And maybe she'd misread the way he reacted. And because her attitude was softening, she agreed to allow him to go during the holiday and have a breakfast meeting with another diplomat, and agreed to meet him at the US Embassy in Nairobi. And she was sitting there 5 minutes after he'd said that he was going to be there, and she realized he was late for the very first time in their marriage, to her recollection, and she knew something terrible was about to happen. And then the US Embassy exploded. It was the Nairobi bombing. The two explosions. That was blamed on Al-Qaeda. And she immediately knew. Well, in that moment, she said, 1,000 things went through her head in 1 second. And she woke up in the arms of a man who had pulled her from the burning rubble. And she didn't know who he was, but he saved her life. He took her to a hospital, which I think was on the outskirts of the city, because all of the city's hospitals were jam-packed. There were so many people injured and killed in these explosions. And most of them either worked in the US Embassy, or they were walking past or working near the US Embassy. It was a horrendous sight. The carnage was appalling. So she was one of the lucky ones. And he took her to a place to recuperate and nursed her back to health. And they ended up, one thing led to another, and they ended up basically sharing their stories. And of course, the first thing that she wanted to know is how it happened, how it came about that he pulled her from the burning building, once she realized what had happened, the explosion, once she came to. And he told her that he was a private mercenary who had been offered a job setting up the bombing at the embassy to blame it on Al-Qaeda, but he hadn't wanted to do it, and he pulled out when he found out that there were quite likely to be innocent civilians on the casualty list. But because of his conscience, he went to the scene to see if there were any survivors who he could pull out of the rubble, which is exactly what he did with her. And this obviously led her to confess to him what she knew about the forthcoming staged event. And of course, he confirmed that that was what was going to take place. And the reason? He'd also been asked to take part in the setting up of that event. So this is what she told me. She also told me about the guy who provided the financial front for the operation of 9/11, and that the front was an Indian tea deal, and that was the vehicle that they used to provide cover for the channeling of the money to the mercenaries. And it turned out that the guy who saved a life was having trouble with his conscience over having been asked to be involved in the 9/11 event, in the staging of it, he decided that he was going to pull out. Because, again, for the same reason, once he found out that there were likely to be innocent people killed, he pulled out. And he was very concerned that his life was going to be taken by the organizer, but it turned out that it wasn't, because the guy, the real architect, the true architect, the one who actually laid down the plans of bringing such an event to fruition, a man with sufficient malevolence to do something like that, is someone who would probably take out his nearest and dearest if he thought they were a threat to him, let alone someone who he just treated as a casual friend or acquaintance. But it turned out that they had history together in the private mercenary business, and he owed him one. So he didn't get assassinated, and he kept his mouth shut. In fact, the only one he told was this woman. And it ended up that he went back to, or they parted at the airport when she was recovered, and she went back to see what was awaiting her at home. And she was told, as soon as she got there, by her husband, who didn't even question her on what had happened. It was like he knew already, and he said, "The marriage is over, I want a divorce, you've been adulterous." And there was a very messy divorce, and she eventually settled and went back to live where her family originated, in Northern Europe. So she tells me all of this, Vinny. And I don't know when you started researching 9/11, but 3 days after 9/11, and for the next 2 to 3 years, it was very difficult to find any hard evidence. There were lots of theories, but to find all the pieces of the jigsaw and put them together to cross-reference all this information that I was given, because that's the pledge that I made to this woman. She said, "Please keep my name out of this," because she was moving to the other side of the world with her family in hiding, because she'd been threatened when she left her husband. She'd been threatened that she had to keep her mouth shut about everything, and they were very worried that she was going to open her mouth after she left. And she knew that she was being bugged, and she was being followed everywhere she went, and she was secretly arranging to go to the other side of the world into hiding. And I haven't heard from her since it happened. But before she went, on the day she went to the airport, she rang me, and we had a conversation. And I promised her that I would cross-reference all the information she'd given me, and that I wouldn't let it out into the public domain until I'd managed to cross-reference all of the facts that could be fact-checked. And everything that she told me, Vinny, everything has checked out. There isn't any aspect of it that hasn't. There's been so much research done by other researchers that proves the things that she told me were true. And the evidence that there was an attempt to take her out in the US embassy bombing, Why, it's unequivocal. She was virtually the only one who wasn't acknowledged in the media. And there were preordained reports ready to go out just after the embassy was bombed.
What did this do to you emotionally? Because when I discovered 9/11 and the things, I think it was Mike Rupert from theWilderness.com. Have you ever heard of him? Former narco, actually. And I saw a documentary of his called The Truth and Lies of 9/11, very low budget, just a presentation in a hall that he did. And my reaction wasn't fear or, "Oh my God, this is so terrible," and what have you. My reaction was hysterical laughter, because all of these connections and all of these people involved in everything like that was so out in the open that it was practically a joke.
Yeah. It's a very good question, because I was as horrified by what she told me as I'd ever been in my life. And mainly because I knew that I could not continue to live the way I'd been living anymore. Because I'd already, two or three years before that, I'd started researching the Bilderberg, so I knew a little bit about what she was talking about. And this was kind of a sign to me that I needed to move in a different direction. because yeah, I had a career in the international film business, and you know, while I left because of the inherent corruption within it, and the fact that it is one of the dirtiest industries imaginable. You know, the people who do well are the ones who will shaft anybody on their way up. And I didn't want to work in that kind of environment. I felt that my creativity was being affected adversely. And as soon as the technology arrived to make my own films, I left it all behind. And I had in the back of my mind that what I would do was write a book imagining a world without money. And that's what I started writing. It was called A World Without Money. And it was to imagine a world where something like 9/11 couldn't happen, where you didn't have the money to pay the mercenaries to organize such a malevolent thing, where there wasn't the money available so the House of Rothschild could continue to control everything covertly and unaccountably, you know, or anybody like that, where it just wasn't possible. And that's what led to... I can only say that I didn't do it consciously, but I did self-destruct. I shed from my life everything and everyone, including wives, who didn't accept me for exactly who I was. And it ended up that the only people left, apart from me, were the ones who really cared. And that was a handful of very good people who helped me through a very dark time. But when I was on my way out of that very dark time, I knew, because there was a fireball of rage every single day when I got up in my belly, that I had to do something about it. I couldn't even contemplate fatherhood unless I had a handle on what I was going to do to make the world a better place. Because I didn't want to bring a child into this mayhem without knowing how to keep them free and safe from the tyrants. You know, and this is what, well, I was lucky enough to meet the mother of my children during this period, would you believe? In all of the darkness, I'm stumbling. I honestly didn't even remember who I was, and yet she recognized me. And when we were pregnant with our daughter, we had a long conversation about registration. And now at this point, I'd revoked my consent to be governed. I'd established by declaration that I wasn't going to give a single penny, no matter what they said, to a criminal government to spend it on the killing of innocents in foreign shores. Mm-hmm. And when this was established, and I'd gotten rid of some fraudulent debt with credit card companies, energy bandits, and I'd gotten to a point where I didn't have any outstanding issues. And I said to my wife, we really can't register. We can't. We just can't do it. So she said, research it, have a look into it, and then we'll talk about it again. Because she knew it would be a big deal. She knew it would instinctively. She's very perceptive and very courageous as well, I have to say. And when I'd researched it, I came back and said, look, the worst that can happen, if they take us to court and I haven't been able to find a single case where someone's been prosecuted, the worst that can happen is a £2 fine. And she said, go for it. We'll do it. We can't do it. It's not the right thing to do. It isn't. Because what I'd also found out in my research was there was a direct link between registering a child and money going into the war chest for illegal wars. In 1929, the criminal government of the United Kingdom created an act called the Government Annuities Act 1929. And this act allowed the Comptroller General to create life annuities in the name of everybody who was registered. And this life annuity is a dividend that's paid every quarter that the beneficiary, the child, is entitled to, but only if it is claimed within the first 7 years. And of course, these facts aren't disclosed to any parents who are registering their children. Therefore, they don't know that they've got to claim the annuity. Otherwise, it's just going to escheat to the crown. And that money gets consolidated by statute into what is known as the Consolidated Fund, which is what they draw on to go to war and many other things. So once I'd explained this to my wife, there was no way we could do it. No matter what they said, no matter what they did, we weren't going to back down. We weren't going to allow our daughter to contribute to the killing of innocents in any way. And especially we weren't going to create a tacit contract with the state for her to become a taxpayer, for them to interfere in her life, for them to send endless letters trying to emotionally blackmail us into getting her vaccinated to put poison into her veins. You know, as everyone who registers, they get these letters telling them that they're doing the wrong thing by not vaccinating. They get told, you know, that their child could have serious problems if they don't. So we took on the Crown and the registrar over the registration. And they said, well, if you don't register, then she's not going to be able to go to school. Well, we're unschooling her, so that's no problem. And that's going phenomenally well, I have to say. She's almost four and she's thriving. Let's just say she's thriving. And we also told the Crown that they weren't entitled to have any of the information pertaining to her very existence because it was private family trust property. Because we created a private family trust and all of the property pertaining to my legal fiction, the name on my birth certificate and the name on my wife's birth certificate, we granted into private trust and the beneficiaries are our children. And that's everything. That's that we have no form of income, or rather my wife does have a form of income. She has one foot in the system. She's a teacher. But she's a very, very good teacher. She's helping children to think for themselves. But she will give that up at a certain point in time when we are financially more able.
I think that she'll wind up getting herself fired at that point, you know.
Look, you teach the children to think. I don't like it. I don't like it at all. You're going to have to go home now. I'm going to cut off your benefits. You know, as you're telling me this really amazing story, it just something occurred to me. I'm a talk radio show host. I do it 5 days a week. It's amazing what the knock-on effects can be from a single important conversation in your life.
That's right. That's right. And I think that's probably the reason why I wanted to express it to you, because I envisaged that we would be talking about every aspect of what's happened to me over the past few years. And it is a story that has never been told publicly, and it's only been told privately to a handful of my most trusted.
Well, I feel very privileged at that point then.
Well, you know, I think this is a very good medium for it, Vinny. And, you know, there is no one doing what you're doing in the way that you're doing it. And, you know, the level of, or rather the quality of the guests that you have on your show, the information that you're putting out, and the fact that you want to have a laugh with it all, I had no hesitation in accepting your very kind invitation.
Oh, well, I guess, I don't know, I guess I'm pretty arrogant and sort of the thing is just like, yep, pretty much. You know.
So you already know that.
Yeah. It's kind of like, what was it? The Matrix. What does the Oracle have above the doorway to the kitchen? Know thyself.
Yeah.
And these kind of things. In fact, do you recall? I watch a lot of movies. There was a film with Nicolas Cage in it called Bringing Out the Dead.
I do. Yes, I didn't see it, but I do recall it.
Well, there's this, I think it might have been Patricia Arquette in it. She's talking to Nicolas Cage and. She's only just met him, like, about 5 minutes ago, and she starts telling him her life story, and all these traumas and everything that happened to her, and she suddenly realizes what she's doing, and she stops herself, and she goes, Jesus, does everybody just spill their guts on you like this? And he says, it must be my eyes. My mother always said, I've got the eyes of a priest. And I feel that I've kind of embodied a lot of the ways that it might not just be my eyes. It's just my mannerism. I am a trustworthy person. I am a caring person. And I ooze it out without thinking about it, you know, because I've trusted so many other people in my life that have turned up screwing me over. And yeah. So I have chosen to model myself on the person who is the direct antithesis to that. So somebody who does not violate somebody's trust, somebody who you can bear your soul and your heart with without fear of rejection or judgment.
Yes.
And that is sorely, sorely fracking missing in talk radio, even in the sphere of talk radio from which I operate within. There's so many other hosts that I've listened to, and I get the impression that they don't actually care about these people that they're talking to.
I can't listen any further once I make that deduction.
Me neither.
I just stop. I turn off and I never go back.
Yeah. Because it's this this lack of empathy within humanity that is driving us apart. And it means that if you want to accomplish something that is different to what's normally happening, you actually have to spend all day, every day at it in order to just to keep it alive, let alone That's right. make it thrive.
That's right. That's right. And at the same time, you must also be acutely aware of how different it is now to how it was 3 years ago. Mm. You know, I mean, you couldn't even mention... You still couldn't mention 9/11 being an inside job or 7/7 or anything like that without people saying you were a crazy conspiracy theorist nutcase.
Mm.
You know, I've heard all that. I've looked on the internet. You know, there's nothing to it. I saw the BBC documentary. They rebutted it all. Well, no, they didn't. But now you got a situation where you can even say to somebody who you don't even know, who you're having a conversation with just by chance, that you bump into them in the street and you just have a conversation. You can even say, of course, the banks are screwing everybody. And they'll nod and say, yes, they are.
Mm.
And I was going to make the point before, in every revolution that was orchestrated by the House of Rothschild since 1815, and probably it would actually be the 50 years before 1815, they started doing it with the French Revolution. And I was going to say, oh God, I think I've lost my thread there. I was going to tell you about what was that subject that I was relating to there?
It was about how revolutions begin and how there is an awakening going on, how people are more open and they agree with things automatically, kind of thing.
Yes, it was that, but unfortunately, it hasn't come back. If it comes back, I'll let you know.
Well, because when you were saying that, what occurred to me is the 100th monkey syndrome, and for those who don't know what it is. There was a study conducted, I forget who or when, I don't know the exact details, but there were monkeys who had figured out that if you used a stick and then you put it into a termite mound, many termites would bite onto the stick, and then you could pull it out and you could actually eat the termites off the stick. And these biologists, I think, were quite fascinated by this. And they were in touch with their colleagues around the world via a telegram or letter or whatever it was at the time. And they found something very interesting, that other monkeys around the world who were separated by continents started doing the exact same thing to termite mounds in their areas of the world. And the conclusion was that as soon as an idea is spread amongst enough members of a particular species, the whole species somehow wirelessly is capable of picking up on those skills, those ideas. Yes. And this is most... well illustrated, I believe, in the human race with the invention of the telescope. Many people don't know that the telescope was invented by 9 men at different points around the world on the exact same night, and none of these men knew each other at all.
Yeah.
You know?
Well,
perhaps we are living in a time now where everybody will be able to see with the distance and the clarity of their own intellectual telescope because of people like us.
Well, that would certainly be the aim, that we would help facilitate that. And I remembered what the point was, and it does link into this conversation. In the testimony of lots of communists who were involved in the Russian Revolution, and and some of them were Trotskyites who were involved in the first government. One of them was called Christian Rakovsky, and there are others who have testified the same. In all of the revolutions that have been sponsored by the House of Rothschild, the people involved in the actual revolution, they take everything except the banks. The banks are left standing. Their buildings are never burned, they're never robbed, they're never looted. They're always left exactly as they were. That's why it's such an important observation to make, that all of a sudden we do find ourselves in a place where all respect has been lost for the banksters. All respect.
They don't deserve any in any way, and I believe that's on the road to a just society, is recognizing that there is a magician, and he's not gifted with magic, he's only a glorified trickster.
Exactly.
We'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, with Michael of Bernicia.